Welcome to Me Time, the podcast for women in midlife who've been taking care of everyone else and now say, it's my turn to take care of me. I'm Kim Aceto, health and self-care coach for women in midlife and your host. Thank you for spending your precious me time with me right now. Enjoy the show. Okay, so today I'm here with Michelle Muldoon. Let me tell you about Michelle. Michelle is a Vancouver-based writer and director who marries her love for action films with a commitment to female-driven stories. She's written and directed short films and music videos that have aired around the world, most recently in Zagreb and Almeria in Spain. A former board member of Women in Film and Television Vancouver, Michelle focused her tenure on the board to create and build the Vancouver International Women in Film Festival screenplay competition. Her latest project was inspired by the Western film she grew up watching with her father. Last Stand in Nowhere is a short proof of concept film that reimagines a gunfight at the OK Corral as a power struggle between sisters, not brothers. Michelle Muldoon currently teaches the introductory screenwriting workshop for Rain Dance Vancouver. Michelle, welcome to the Me Time Midlife Podcast.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I'm really happy to be here.
Yeah. Well, I heard you speak and I was just fascinated by your journey and I can't wait to talk with you today. But before we get into that, let me, since you're a first time guest, let me ask you this question since it's the Me Time Midlife Podcast. Yep. What do you enjoy doing during your me time?
That's a tougher question than it appears to be.
That'll be the toughest question I ask.
I think me time when you're really passionate about something is a struggle to find and to have. But me time for me is going to a movie on my own and not with somebody. Uh-huh. It's because I live near the Arbutus Greenway. It's a walk on the Greenway. And sometimes it's just a coffee in a cafe with a window seat so I can watch the world go by.
Nice. Sounds like we kind of like doing the same things, but you know, you are a film person. So what is it about going by yourself to the movies that you enjoy?
I really enjoy the fact that I can do it spontaneously. Mm-hmm. So it's that decision of what's on at 6:30, it's 5 o'clock. I live near Fifth Avenue Cinema. So, you know, I can look it up, take a quick look and go, I think I'll see this. And it's not something I have to negotiate with anybody. I just have to negotiate it with myself.
That's right.
So, and I love sitting in the theater and sometimes sitting towards the back and again, watching people. I think people are fascinating. And if you tell stories, watching people is the best way to find them.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Yeah. I love that. Okay. So I'm going to start here with kind of a broader question here. And I want you to really, elaborate on whatever your thoughts are as we go through this today. But I just came across a couple of statistics that I wanted to share with you, which I'm sure you're not surprised about, but I'd like you to talk about these a little bit. Let me share some of these things with you here. 21% of filmmakers are women. Mm-hmm. 31% of speaking roles are held by women. And 23% of films feature women protagonists. So,
yes.
So you're familiar with these statistics here?
Yeah, they're all abysmal. They've been abysmal forever. Well, they've been abysmal for years. I mean, when Hollywood first came into existence, women were much more prevalent in the whole system, surprisingly. A lot of, I think, the numbers went down. I think it was probably after talkies came in and then probably into the World War II, numbers started to slip. They've been down for a long time. They've had a small upsurge recently, upsurge in television primarily, but it's still nowhere near representative of the fact that we're 51% of the population. So it's abysmal. I always say that if the policies that exist subversively in film were ever attempted to be used in corporate life, there would be, you know, there would be lawsuits and fines all over the place. but that's not the way the creative industry works. And so the numbers are starting to change because male allies are starting to voice that. And we need change from people in position in power. Otherwise, the people knocking at the door will always knock at the door. And we're slowly starting to see that. So I think change is coming. Change is happening really slowly. I don't even know if I will see enough change in my lifetime, but I do believe that that change works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And you're really much into that, right? Really promoting women in film. And I mean, you just created a all-female Western. So that is really cool.
Yeah, I love telling those stories, and I kind of gravitated to them. And I think it's really interesting that, you know, the things they tell you when you first start out is the truth. And the things they tell you is the more you write, the better you will get, which is true. The thing they tell you is that you will find your voice the more you write, which is true. And you will find your genre by dabbling and experimenting in all genres. And that is also true.
Mm. Mm-hmm. So how did you get into filmmaking in the first place?
Kind of happenstance, really. Hmm. So I would say the first half of my life was really all about sport. You know, I was a fairly successful high school athlete. I played club volleyball. I made my university team as a walk-on. And then when I moved to Vancouver, I went into coaching, and I had a really good run with club and high school volleyball. But I think after, you know, decades of that, I started really wanting to do something for me. And I started dabbling with actually short stories first. And I found just, again, that me time. It was my initial me time away from something else that spurred this. A friend of mine took a look at what I was writing and said, you know, I work in the industry, and she actually works in LA, and she says, you know, you write more like a screenwriter than a narrative fiction writer. So I was at an event, a friend of mine had gotten me into an event down in Vegas where eventually I was sitting in a room with a bunch of broadcast educators who were there to hear Anthony Zeiker speak. And he was the creator of all the CSIs. And Anthony said, you know, I don't hire film school grads. And the whole room went flat except for me. My ears perked up.
Right.
Right. And he said, you know, they generally won't pour my coffee. And the last person I hired to pour my coffee happens to run one of my TV shows now.
Mm.
You know, he believed you had to start at the absolute bottom and work your way up. And I left that and went and bought my first copy of Final Draft screenwriting software because it was on special at the event. And I started writing, and I sent it to someone to read, and I found out I was absolutely terrible at it because I didn't understand it.
Hmm.
I didn't understand how different it was and what rules or guidelines I needed to understand about storytelling to make it work. So I found a mentor, someone I'd heard speak at a workshop, and I just worked really hard with her for several years until I could reach a certain level that was acceptable. And within that time, I also, I entered my first film festival screenwriting competition about a year after working with this woman whose name is Pilar Alessandra. And I won it. And the festival director at that said, well, you wrote something that won something. Why don't you go make something? And, you know, it kind of made sense because I didn't really understand the translation of page to screen because you do have to understand that process. And I was too green to know that was going to be a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
So I was also taking another program with a group in a group setting, and the group was like gung-ho. So we made our first short film together, or my first short film together. And I learned a lot, and it just kept going from there.
Mm-hmm. What was that first short film that you made?
Oh, that'll probably won't see the light of day.
Okay.
none of us ever put out our first short film. It was called Potluck.
Okay.
It did play at two festivals. It's the cast, I think, did a great job. I think I'm a better storyteller today, and I think I'm a better director today. I almost wish they, you know, you almost wish people would get you the second or third, fourth time round. I haven't put it online. It had a small run, and I'm happy with it, but I really feel it's sort of not indicative of what I can do now. So I never quite made it online, but we did play a couple of festivals, and the cast and the effort of everybody is fantastic. And I need it to be better, I think. And that's what I learned in the process. So I put the same kind of bury your head down and learn what you need to learn, because the journey is, once you do it once, you should be able to do it twice, and you should be better the second time. Right. So, you know, that's sort of the sport mentality coming into film. And that's sort of where I'm at now. So every time I make something, my goal is not just to do it well, but to do it as well as I can on that day. And the next time I do it, I want to be better than I was that day. I want to be a better collaborator and more communicative. I want to understand the story and the process better. I want to understand my shot selection better. I mean, the list of things as a director that you can improve on every time you go out is massive.
Mm-hmm. So writing and filmmaking was kind of a midlife hobby for you. And then you found out after much practice and taking classes and getting a mentor that you just kept getting better and better at it.
Yeah. I think that's probably the best way to put it. I don't think of it as a hobby. I mean, right now it's it may not be the way I'm earning a living, but it is the direction I want to take. And I view this as building a portfolio and also creating content that I can pitch and looking for that opportunity.
Yeah. And there are quite a few midlife women who are, you know, kind of have a similar story to you in that they've been doing something for, you know, first half of their life, and then they want to do something else, whether it's photography or, I don't know, filmmaking or writing or something like that. What do you think you brought to your work now in midlife that maybe you weren't able to bring if you would have gone into this?
That's a huge difference, I think. Well, I first of all, I think the more mature you get, the bigger your worldview is. And how you look at, like, you can see things very clearly on a broader scale. And I think to write a story, you need to understand that. You need to understand your character's place in the world. You need to understand what that world is, or what that character's worldview is. So I think from a writing perspective, I think you gain a ton. As, you know, entering sort of producing and directing to make content happen, you bring in all the skills from every job or every passion you've had before then. And there's a lot of soft skills that are transferable, starting one with communication skills to organizational skills. You know, all these things are highly transferable. For me, as a coach, I'm a level 2 certified coach, which means I'm certified to coach at up to the national level in my sport. I can take my team to nationals. And the skills I gained from coaching, which is program planning, you know, motivation, communication, skill or game day breakdowns and planning, like all of those things are highly transferable to producing and directing. And so for me, it wasn't just that I had the skills I could transfer, but they were skills I felt confident in because I had practiced them somewhere before. And I think that's what you bring. You bring that confidence in them as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that, because a lot of women are, you know, kind of, they're getting into some new venture that they're excited about, but there's some hesitation because they feel like they're late to the game. Right. But I think what you mentioned was that you bring a lot of that experience, maturity, wisdom, you know, and transferable skills, absolutely, to your next new interest. So
I think the other thing you bring in is like perspective. I think what's amazing, the older you get, is all those things that happened to you, let's say in your 20s, the things that felt so crushing or so difficult, the times you get disappointed because you haven't got the resume yet for it, or any of that. I think one of the key things you learn in all of that is it doesn't kill you.
Right.
right? Yes. like you still have to, you know, wake up the next morning and, you know, pull your pants on, put your shoes on, and you have to go at it again. And I think that's one of the most important lessons of our youth. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what also helped me.
Yeah.
You know, the later in life change.
Right, right. Yeah, you get more resilient. That's for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
So let's talk about what has been like the stereotype of women in Westerns. What has been kind of the past and what do you, you know, what do you see now and what do you hope to see?
Yeah. Oh, well, you know, we talk a lot in Westerns about the trope is the Madonna whore trope. Mm. You're either the long-suffering farm wife who's much the angel of everybody, or you're the chaste young girl, you know, who's also perfect, or you're the saloon hooker, right?
Yeah.
There's really not a lot of depth in between. And, you know, it's prevalent throughout all Westerns. Like you see it in the American Westerns of the 50s, all right, up to the 50s and 60s. And then you get this break where we go to the sort of the spaghetti Westerns, the Italian Westerns of the 60s and 70s, where it was that, or there were no women in it at all. Right.
Yeah.
You know, in that whole period, you got a movie called an American movie called Hanny Calder about a woman who's gang raped, and the poster has Raquel Welch only in a poncho, you know, which is a really bad message. And then as a kid, one of my favorites was a movie called Two Mules for Sister Sarah. Mm. And now I realize that it's probably the worst of them all because, you know, the reason I loved it was Shirley MacLaine was in it. And she was like, she and Clint Eastwood were almost partnered through the whole movie. She wasn't second fiddle at all. And which is kind of to go back a little bit, Maureen O'Hara would have been the closest thing to it in the 50s, mm-hmm. right? And the problem is she plays a saloon hooker hiding out as a nun to travel hostile territory. So she's both in one.
Right.
So they didn't, you know, like, well, let's just cut out one of the women. We'll make her both. you know, so, you know, this is fairly common. Mm-hmm. There was a movie made a few years ago called Hostiles. It's really, really good in how it's sort of creating another ripple of revision to the way we tell Westerns. Mm-hmm. But again, you know, it's really the guy's story. And there's a lot of women like me who grew up watching Westerns with their dad. I hear it every time we screen, you know, and I hear it from women who are excited about seeing an alternative. Every time we screen at a festival, I hear it. Mm-hmm. And it shows me that we are not pushing the envelope far enough in how we reinvigorate the genre.
What? So you just created a new film called Last Stand to Nowhere, and I was fortunate to be able to see it, although it's not out yet, right? Maybe till the fall, people won't be able to?
Yeah.
Access it?
Okay. If you live in Miami, Oklahoma, Las Cruces, New Mexico, Vancouver, BC, or St. Augustine, Florida, we are screening over the next few months in those cities.
Okay. Okay, yeah. Great. So, you know, you made this all-female Westerns called Last Stand to Nowhere. Why did you make this film?
Well, first of all, I have to admit something terrible, and that is that sometimes I start something not realizing why I'm doing it till I'm about partway through. I just know that this is what I'm supposed to be doing. I refer to it as you take steps on a path based on conviction sometimes before you know why. So I first thought of the idea about 5 years ago. I was on one of the West sets in town, one of the Western sets, helping somebody for their short film by digging a cemetery on a Friday afternoon. Mm-hmm. And these are the sort of things you do in Vancouver independent film. and we took a break and we walked down the middle of Main Street. I was like, it reminds me of the Western movies I saw when I was a kid. And, you know, wouldn't it be great if, and everybody was like, yeah, that'd be a lot of fun. And I kept talking about this idea with people, and everybody was like saying that'd be a lot of fun, and then some of the actors I knew were like, I'd do that. So I was working on a feature script, and I was sort of a little blocked. So I decided, why don't I just write this? So, you know, about a year later, I wrote the first draft and, you know, sent it out for some notes and got some notes back and just sort of kept plugging away in it. And then people were like, well, there's a funding application coming up. Do you want to, maybe we should apply. Will you go on it with me? And it just started happening that layers kept building and people keep coming along. And then we struggled to get funding because, probably a lot of reasons. I do think that when we first started this journey, we were a little way out there. For some of them, you know, we weren't a drama, we weren't cultural, we weren't about relationships, we weren't about, you know, sort of a lot of things that get funded.
Right.
And so we went to crowdfunding, and we had a really successful crowdfunding campaign that basically paid for about 80% of our budget.
Wow.
75-80% of our budget came out of crowdfunding. Mm-hmm. And and cast kept coming on board, and before you knew it, you know,
yeah,
we were there.
Right. Yeah. I saw the list of all the, what do you call them?
Crowdfunders.
Yeah. Crowdfunders. Yeah. At the very end, I was like, oh, wow, this is great.
What it means is we're a community grassroots film, mm-hmm. which tells you right off the bat that people are interested in the idea, and that, I think women are hungry for something different. I always say, you know, for those people who have seen Godless on Netflix, the most sort of extreme character, Maggie, if you read Twitter, is the most popular because mm-hmm. she pushes the envelope the furthest. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think the genre, those who love the genre, are waiting for.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let me tell you, the film is excellent. I watched it yesterday, and I mean, it's just some badass women, you know? I mean, it's awesome. And the set and everything is just really good. And and it's, I mean, it's not these dainty girls, mm-mm. you know, who don't know how to handle a gun. I mean, there's a lot of, I mean, did they all do their own stunts, or did you have people?
The only stunt that was done by a stunt performer, a woman by the name of Andrea Ross, mm-hmm. Was the opening shot down the stairs.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
Otherwise.
I oh my gosh.
Yeah. ironically, or not interestingly,
yeah.
Andrea also stunt doubled for Wynonna Earp.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the actress uh-huh. who plays Wynonna Earp. So yeah. Here she was stunt doubling for the foil of Wyatt Earp or Wynonna Earp.
Right.
Or Wylona, which is Billy Clanton. Yeah, there's this really fun connection in that for us.
So what message are you trying to kind of send here with this all-female Western?
I think we send out a lot of different messages. Mm. Initially, I wanted to make a movie that women who love Westerns can finally connect with. And I think that was one of the lessons of, for instance, Wonder Woman. Like, women walked out of the theater saying, this is how the guys feel when they watch a superhero. There's so much more connection when it's somebody who looks like you. So the journey is more connected. The feelings, the failures, everything is just ramped up a little bit more when you actually see yourself in those characters. So I wanted that connection for women. I like to say we're a feminist Western that does not beat you over the head with a message. We're fun. You can get into it. But at the end of it, you think, why can't women play these roles? You know,
that's right.
And that's kind of what I want. I want you to enjoy it. Mm-hmm. I don't want to hit you over the head with a message, but I want you to understand that women are far more complex than what we give female actors on television. Those actors would have hit me if I said put makeup on. It was almost a contest to see who could go with the least amount of anything
right.
and the most amount of dirt, right? They just wanted more dirt.
Yeah.
Because, you know, and all of them have said this, you know, it was liberating to be able to have so little on and play a character. I had told them that, you know, you're all beautiful women, but you're not going to be beautiful in this movie. And it turned out to be not true. And I would, you know, I remember turning around to some people in Video Village. Video Village is where the director hangs out. It's got the monitor. You converse with your director of photography about how the shot's going. Your script supervisor's in Video Village because she can give you, or he, whichever, can give you feedback on whether or not you've got continuity issues or, you know, things like that. So I remember turning around in the village and saying, you know, that was kind of sexy, that last shot. And I didn't think this film was going to be sexy. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, am I wrong? And everybody's like, no, you're not wrong. And so later on, I was chatting with one of the actors and I said, you know, I kept saying this in the village and I'm like, there's something wrong about that. And she goes, no. I said, why? She said, well, a woman in her full power, regardless of makeup or clothing or how she looks, is always sexy.
Mm.
And it's that ability and that freedom to express ourselves in multiple ways, in complex ways, in sometimes beautiful and sometimes dirty ways, that really makes a woman attractive to the world. It's not looks, it's not how stylish you are, it's being present and full and expressive of who you are. Mm. And I think that has ultimately become the lesson of this film.
Mm. Yeah, I love that. Another thing too is I appreciated that the actors were all shapes and sizes.
You know, the only thing I was concerned about was finding the right people for the part.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they were all people I wanted and they all said yes. And that's all I cared about because yeah. They are extremely talented actors.
They are. Yeah. Even the woman who sang in the beginning and then at the end.
Yes. Lenny is an interesting story, actually. So Lenny and I are good friends. We're old friends, mm-hmm. Our longstanding friends, because I hate the O word. Lenny sings in 8 languages.
Wow.
Yeah. She sings in Cantonese and Mandarin. She sang in Japanese on Man in the High Castle, English, French, Tagalog, Italian. She's really talented. So Lenny had said to me, I want to be your saloon singer. I said, okay. And she said, I want to pick a song for the film. It'll be an old song so that there won't be any chain of title issues. I'm like, okay. Sure. She goes, you don't have to use it. I said, no, I have a composer on board. Mm-hmm. And she said, but let's give it a try. And so I said, sure. So she comes in the first morning and I hadn't heard the song yet. She was, because I knew I can use part of it. I can use all of it. I can use none of it. I really wasn't concerned. I was more concerned. I knew Lenny was passionate about being a part of the film and helping and passionate about music. And she picked the perfect song.
So last thing, Michelle, before we go is, so what's been the response so far for the film and what have been some surprises maybe?
Well, we've now sitting at 18 festival selections, which is great. We were nominated for 2 awards at the Leos last year, which is the BC Film Awards, which was fantastic. Mm-hmm. Our poster is actually an original piece by Texas artist Felice House, who is phenomenally talented, whose specialty is female reimaginings of iconic Western images, which was kind of a perfect connection. Mm-hmm. Our poster is a 60x40 oil on canvas within her art exhibit now. Mm-hmm. The learning curve with that was, even if you don't know somebody, reach out and ask, you'd be surprised who will come aboard.
Mm-hmm.
And that poster sat in the Museum of the Southwest in Texas for 2 months last summer, and the film exhibited with it. That was probably one of the highlights for us. We played at a couple of festivals where we had a couple of sort of crusty people over it, you know, particularly a couple of older gentlemen. That kind of died down. Women in particular love it.
Mm-hmm.
Men who really truly know the genre have been really supportive. We were the only Canadian film at the Almeria Western Film Festival, which is the home of the sets and still maintains the love of the Sergio Leone spaghetti westerns. So mm-hmm. That's the Dollars trilogy in particular, Good, Bad, and the Ugly, Fistful of Dollars, A Few Dollars More, considered some of the greatest films of the genre. They celebrate that with a festival. We were one of only 13 short films, the only Canadian and the only female director, and they were very open. All the European men wanted to talk about it. They wanted to understand how we made it happen and who the cast was. And the openness and the excitement was incredibly rewarding. Initially, we had some problems. One person online told me I would fail with this film. But when we found the people who really love the genre, it's been great from there on out.
That's great. Well, Michelle, thank you so much for coming on to the podcast and congratulations on the success of the film. You mentioned those different film festivals that it'll be playing at. For those who don't live in those areas, how can they maybe stay in touch with what's going on, with what you're doing or where the film is, and maybe they can see it sometime? I don't know. Is there a way for people to keep in touch with what you're up to?
Absolutely. The film does have social media channels. We are on Facebook, Last Stand to Women to Know We're a Female Western, on Twitter and on Instagram as Last Stand Number Two Nowhere, because they don't give us enough room. I'm available through Twitter and Instagram as Paisley Media 1 and 2. I post a lot on both the Twitter and the Facebook feeds about where we're going and what we're up to. And we'll do the same with when we go live post festival, probably by end of October. But we are hoping for a number of screenings still to come throughout the summer. And we're super excited about finding a home for us after we get through that.
That'd be great. Well, congratulations again, Michelle, on your success. And it's great. And for the message that you're sending out there as well. So I really appreciate you coming on and talking about this with us today.
Oh, thanks for the time and the soapbox. I could talk about Westerns all day long. Thanks again. Appreciate it.
Thank you. If you find the Me Time Midlife podcast valuable, there are many ways you can support it. The best way is to simply tell your midlife friends about it. It also helps the show's visibility if you rate and review it on iTunes, Stitcher, or simply directly in your Apple Podcasts app if you listen to the show that way. And if you want more me time in your life and continue the conversations we have on the show with other women on a similar journey, consider joining our Me Time Midlife community on Facebook. Simply search for Me Time Midlife Community in your Facebook search bar, or go to metimemidlifepodcast.com to learn more. Thank you again for listening. And until next time, remember, you've been taking care of everyone else. It's your turn to take care of you.